Okay. Welcome to Stay Awake After Lunch 101. I'm probably going to do something that I don't know for sure, but it may be the first time that this has ever been done during a class at the 2-week meeting. I actually got a question last week before I'd ever stood up here and said anything. So I'm going to start with a question that was given to me because it's a concept of the idea of how is the church going to survive that I hadn't really intended on going into very much at all, really. Not I hadn't thought about talking about it, period. But it's probably one that we need to at least bring up and point out, and possibly if there's time at the end, I might talk a little more about this. The idea, anyway. The idea is about persecution against Christians in the U.S. and how will we deal with that in the future? Well, the easy answer to that is we remain steadfast, immovable, and keep our trust in the Lord. Prayer, study, fellowship, all those things are a part of how I see the early Christians endured the persecutions they were under. I do want to address the specific question. The specific question was about Michael Salman, S-A-L-M-A-N. Have you heard about this guy? He's from Phoenix. You may have seen the headline on your internet or on your news or in an email or something. Arizona preacher jailed for holding Bible studies in his home. You seen that? Okay. And our initial reaction, and this is what's happened, is to get all up in arms and everybody starts crying foul and this is wrong and all this stuff. And I did a little more digging because I thought something's not right. And then I started seeing the conflicting sides to the story. Every story's got two sides, doesn't it? So I read their side. And their side is, we're holding a Bible study in our home and they're angry because there's so many cars and we're all in our yard and we're not blocking the drive and the neighbors have a Super Bowl party or a Tupperware party and they've got cars all over the street and there's no problem with that. That's one side of it. The other side of it is that I'm not sure that they're telling the whole truth. Because as I look into the situation, this was not they knocked on his door and took him to jail. By the way, I think it's 60 days in jail and $12,000 fine. That's what he's paying. But this whole thing, if I understand the chronology right and from the facts that I've been able to gather, this whole thing goes all the way back to 2006. This issue has been going on. And this man, they were having a Bible study in their home and it began to grow. And so he built a building on their property. If you look at the pictures of this building, it is enormous. It's big. It's just like a big metal building with a roof. Inside the building are all these chairs all facing one direction, and at the front is a pulpit. He says it's a garage. There are as many as 80 people at a time that are meeting twice a week in this building and giving tithes during that time. Giving. Outside toward the front of his property is one of those signs that has the removable, changeable lettering with a tall cross right beside it. Okay. He advertises himself or this group as Harvest Christian Church on the internet and on materials. He claims tax exemption status for the church, for when they buy supplies and different things. They have a tax-exempt number. This sounds to me like it's going a little bit beyond a few people getting together to study the Bible once or twice a week. he is holding an actual church service and meeting that way and advertising it that way on his property. And the city of Phoenix, from 2006 on, has said, I keep saying the city of Phoenix. I'm really not sure exactly what little suburb borough it's technically in, so I just say Phoenix. They are saying, we don't have a problem with you having a church on this property. I even read the citation from the zoning laws for churches, and I don't think I wrote that down. No, I didn't write it down. I should have. But it basically, the actual law on the books says that a church building may be built in any zoned area within this area. So a church could buy property in the middle of an industrial park or in the middle of a residential area or in the middle of a business district. The city doesn't care. If the church owns the property and builds a church and starts meeting there, that's fine with the city. They don't care. So that's not the issue. The issue isn't that it's in a residential area. The issue is that he is acting like a church, behaving like a church, advertising like a church, conducting business governmentally like a church, but he's refusing to submit to the codes that the city asks him to keep the building up to. There's no exit signs inside the building. It's not necessarily handicapped accessible. There was a couple of other things. I don't remember exactly all of it was. Because he's been cited... he was found guilty of 67 Class 1 misdemeanors, all in relation to the building codes for a church building within that area. And this is unfortunate to me, because to me this is, Romans chapter 13, right? To me this is a man standing in defiance of the governmental authorities for no reason other than to just be defiant. He could very easily fix this. And they've given him 6 years to fix this. And he just continues to refuse. And now, they're on TV and in the media and on the internet crying religious persecution. And to me, the reason that's unfortunate is because there are plenty, and I'm not going to take any time right now to go through them, there are plenty of examples, even in the U.S., of people that really are being treated badly and persecuted because of their religious belief. Take the Chick-fil-A guy right now. Why is the government being allowed to get involved in a business because of what the owner believes? I doubt they do that with any other business. Because I've seen owners of businesses get out there and say all kinds of stuff, and they never crack down on their businesses. So there's plenty of examples of real life, actual damaging persecution going on, and then to have this happen, and what do people do? They do the same research and background and everything I do, and they go, those religious nuts. They just want to have it their own way and make everybody do things the way they want them to and rebel. And that's unfortunate, isn't it? Because that's not how God tells us to behave as Christians. God tells us to obey the authorities within the law, if at all possible. So, what has the church here had to do? Last time I was here, you didn't have an exit in the basement. That back exit? Is that fairly new? Okay. Now, why did you put that up? Why did you build that in? I'm sure it was just because you had nothing else to do on a Saturday. It cost you money. It cost you time. It cost you inconvenience so that you could do that, because some government official came in and said, we require you to have that. So you did it. And that's how we're supposed to be as Christians. That's how we're supposed to be. If I don't want to open this up too much for questions right now, because this is a subject that we could go the rest of the week on. And I don't plan on doing that.
Not a question.
Okay.
There has been a suggestion on the media concerning Chick-fil-A that to show your support, go into them, patronize them, certainly on August the 1st. There are three Chick-fil-A's in Springfield, one of them being very near U.S. 60.
We've already been to one, and it's delicious as always.
Yeah, well, we have to get
my, well, he's not up here, so I'll say this. My son Aiden rates fast food places on their chicken sandwiches. And right now, Chick-fil-A is number one on his list. So that's pretty good from him. Okay, we're going to go on into the topic that I had. If there are any more questions or thoughts on this, feel free to put them in the box. I'll try to address them as best I can. But I guess my end point is we have to be careful as Christians, who we defend and support, and who we are realistic about, because there's all kinds of people out there trying to take advantage of this, that, or the other thing, and we have to make sure we're not one of them. Okay, my topic for this week is how will we survive as a church? I guess I get to be the looking into the future part. Rick's done some looking into the past, and now I get to try to pretend that I'm the prophet. But I'm not. I'm not a prophet. I can't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, any more than the next person can. And if they say they can, it's time to walk away and find a new friend, because they don't know what they're talking about. We can make certain predictions based on information we have, like these things we've been talking about. I do feel like we're moving into a time period, not where it will, but where it has the possibility of becoming a time period where there will be an increased amount of pressure and persecution on Christians. I can't say that it will, because I don't know what will happen tomorrow. People's attitudes about things change all the time. So what I decided to do was break it down, and I think I was smart enough to decide I don't think I can cover five topics in 5 days, so I've got four topics that I'm for sure going to get to, and I think we'll cover them in 5 days, and I've got some stuff for the last day if I cover that. I got more topics we can talk about, but my goal is to get through these four. I want to talk, and this is what we'll spend primarily today on, but I'm going to give you the overview for the class. I want to talk about the idea of protecting the next generation. I wish that my generation, when we were teenagers, were as knowledgeable and as dedicated as they seem to be right now. I don't know how many of you travel to the various meetings and so forth, but every place I go, there's a horde of teenagers. I think at camp this year, at the camp out down in Eminence, they counted 150 age 18 and down. That's a lot. And I'm here to tell you, a lot of those teenagers were there with people watching out for them other than their parents. They weren't there because mom and dad drug them. They were there because they wanted to be. Two-week meetings seem to be the same way every year. We have that the last few years. I've helped out with the teen study that they have at Gregory in the wintertime. And we've been running 60 to 75 kids at that for 3 days in between Christmas and New Year's, when most teenagers would rather be sleeping in. But they're there all day for 3 days studying and fellowshipping together. It's amazing to me. But we can't just sit back and go, great, they're doing a great job, and call it good. We have to take some steps to protect the next generation, and we're going to talk about that today. The second topic I want to talk about is the idea of teaching, keeping, and restoring. These are Christians that, for whatever reason, are new or weak or falling away. Okay? Because I think that's the second... I don't know. I tried to decide if I really thought that these... When I first put this together, I put it together in what I thought was kind of most important to least important. And then as I kept working on it, I decided I couldn't really do that because I wasn't sure it was. But this is the second topic we'll talk about because I think there's different facets. One is keep the generation you've got and build them up to a stronger future. The second idea is take the people that are there that don't seem to be quite as strong and sturdy and mature and try to bring them along and develop them in that. And so we're going to spend a day talking about teaching, keeping, and restoring. Then we're going to spend probably 2 days, I'm guessing, talking about convicting the non-believer. This may be something that we need to delve a little bit more into than we do sometimes, I'm afraid. I can remember back in my generation, and what I heard a lot, not from everybody, but what I heard a lot was, well, we just have to live the Christian life and they'll be drawn to us. Well, there is some truth to that. We are supposed to be lights. We are supposed to be ready for when people ask us about the hope and joy that is within us. But that's not it. We have to be willing to say things and find those opportunities and look for those doors, look for those windows, find those cracks where we can get something planted so that we can be ready, so that we can bring them into the church. And so we're going to talk about 10 different kinds of skeptics, and we're going to talk about the parable of the sower and see if we can mesh kind of all that together. Okay, so we'll spend, I think it'll probably take a couple of days, if not almost 2 days, to do that. And then the last topic I want to talk about is the process of God's people turning away from Him. Because I think one of the other things that happens is we have to make sure that the Christians that right now we look around us and go seem solid and founded and ready and make sure they don't find their way back into the world. What happens? Because I think there is, I don't know that it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 step process, but I think there are some things that happen as God's people slowly move away from Him back to the world. And we're going to kind of try to investigate each of those. So there's the general outline. There's what you're in for the rest of the week. You ready? All right. I hope I am. We're going to talk first about protecting the next generation. I want us to go to Psalm 78. In my work, I don't know how this has worked out. It's okay with me because I like it. But I've ended up doing over the course of the years a lot of work with teenagers, both in the church and outside the church. And this passage, as I've been going into some of these things and getting older, this passage right here has started to mean even more and more to me over the years. And I want to start here in verse 1. I think, yeah. We're going to start reading we'll start reading in verse 1. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and His strength and His wonderful works that He has done. For He has established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments, and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. We're supposed to raise up a godly generation, right? Do you see the qualifier in that passage? Not just a godly generation, a godly generation more godly than ourselves. Do you notice that? And to me, as mature Christians, as adults, as parents, as grandparents, that should be our goal right there. Not just to raise up somebody that comes to services every week, but to raise up somebody, to raise up children and grandchildren and another generation that is stronger, that is more knowledgeable, that is more devoted, that is more dedicated than we were. I told the kids downstairs earlier, I said, I can remember growing up. And we would go to the meetings. We would go to the weekend meetings, and we'd go to the two-week meeting, and we'd go here, there, and yonder. And I'd see teenagers there, and we'd get together, and we'd do things. And then, you know, we kind of had that time in our life where people started getting married and having little kids, and we didn't go to the meetings quite as often. And then when I started going back to the meetings, I looked around and went, well, where's so-and-so? Where's so-and-so? And I started hearing stories about, oh, well, they left for whatever reason, or they walked away, or they married so-and-so and it just pulled them away. It's heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. What happened? What happened? I don't have an answer for that. I wish I did. I wish I did. But all I know is that we can't change the past. That's what I know. But what we can do is affect the future. And one way we can do that is doing everything within our power to take the generation that is growing up now and try to make them better than we were. That's what we can do. That's what we can have a goal as. But I love this. You know, notice where it says in verse 4, will not hide them, the dark sayings, the mysteries, the difficult things. We won't hide them from our children. That is so important. We have a tendency, I think, once in a while to water down the gospel. Try to make it more palatable. We're going to talk about that a lot when we talk about reaching out to the outsider, convicting the non-believer. Our children need to know the truth. And my experience with teenagers, and when I said this down, I made this statement downstairs because I wanted to see how they would react. I made the statement, I've found that teenagers, even when they don't like it, they want to be told the truth. I saw a lot of heads going like this downstairs in that teen class. They want the truth, even if it's hard to digest. There's something I say to my kids and to teenagers a lot, that sometimes the truth hurts, because it does. Sometimes I don't want to know the truth, really. I do, but it's not too easy going down, you know. They want to know the truth. We can't hide things. We can't try to make it easier for them. That's not the goal. We can't raise up a more godly generation by trying to make it more easier. That doesn't work. But the part that really always hits me is there in verse 8. That they may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation. I just always look at that and I think, I reflect that back on my generation, and hopefully you can reflect that back on your generation and use that as a mirror to guide yourself by. Whatever I knew when I was their age, I'd really like them to know more. I'd really like them to know more. Okay. I have four ways that we as adults, I think, can do this. Now, there's lots of others. There's lots of other ways. But I want to look specifically at four. Encouragement. Okay, encouragement. Let's go for a second to the book of Acts. I know you know this story, but I just want to reinforce it. Because to me, well, here, let's open it up. What does it mean to you to be encouraging to someone? Build them up. Okay? Keep it up. Challenge them. Okay, good. I like that. I think encouragement leads them to continue trying. Even when they fail. Even when they fail. Who needs the most encouragement? Somebody who knows their books of the Bible all the way through without thinking too much about it, or somebody that's struggling a little bit? Person that's struggling. Who needs the most encouragement? The young man that gets up to lead songs or give a lesson or offer a prayer and he just does a marvelous job, or the one that kind of struggles a little bit and is obviously nervous and just doesn't do the polished job we think they should? What's the one that struggled a little bit? Does that mean the one that did the great job doesn't need any encouragement? Oh, they're fine? Oh, I hope not. Because we're setting ourselves up to just apathy, like Mark was talking about. Well, that's good enough. I don't think I've ever given a lesson where I didn't sit down and think, oh, I could have done this better and that better, and I should have said this. It's just how we are. It's just how we operate. We never do everything perfectly right. So they need the encouragement. Even when they fail, sometimes that's when they need the more encouragement. And most of the time, they don't need to be told what they did wrong. They might need a hint of that from a person or two, but not from everybody. What they need is, I think you know you can do a little bit better, and I'm confident. I'm looking forward to your next lesson. I'm looking forward to the next time I hear you pray. Encouragement, even when they fail. Acts chapter 4. Remember Joseph? Verse 36. And Joseph, who was also named Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated son of encouragement, a Levite of the country of Cyprus. I have a lot of characters in the Bible that I really like, but I have to say that Barnabas may be one of my top five favorite. And I think it's because I know him by the name Barnabas, because that wasn't his name. Barnabas was a nickname. That's what they called him. It wasn't his real name. I just think that is so amazing. Well, how would it be if all of us were known by the brethren for our most positive quality that we had as a Christian? And when they saw you, they didn't call you by your name, they called you by what you were known by. Known as the forgiver, the lover, the merciful one, the encourager. Wouldn't that be cool? And here they just take up this name for him, the encourager. Every time he walked into the assembly, there's the encourager. Every time they called on him for a prayer, could the encourager come up and speak a few words, please? Wouldn't that be amazing? And was his nickname well deserved? Sure it was. We know the story. Acts chapter 7, verse 58. Saul of Tarsus is right there while they're stoning Stephen. Okay? But we know God had more things planned for him. So in Acts chapter 9, after he's been converted. It's Barnabas that goes and wants to see what's going on. So when it comes time and they go down to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 9, starting around verse 26, Paul wants to be one of them, but they aren't too sure about him. And who comes to his rescue? The encourager. The obvious one. Barnabas. And then in Acts chapter 15, this may be why he's one of the reasons why he's one of my favorites. In Acts chapter 15, verse 36, when Paul decides, hey, let's go back and visit those people we talked to the first time around, what becomes an issue? John Mark. Oh, that poor young lad. John Mark. How does Paul see him? The one who left. He wasn't with us long at all, and he just quit and went home. Now, we don't know why. We don't know how old he was. We don't know why he went home. We have none of those details. Barnabas probably knew. But we have none of those details. And all Paul can see, this is the kid that left. This is the kid that quit on us. But does Barnabas see him that way? No. Barnabas is the encourager. He encouraged them. He led him to continue trying even though he had failed. At least in Paul's eyes. Even though he had failed. Possibly in his own. I don't know the circumstances. So he encouraged him to continue. So much so that he was willing to stand at odds against an apostle that he had traveled with and learned with and taught probably a little bit and admired. He was willing to dig in his feet and stand his ground for this young man. Amazing. How many of us would do that? How many of us would do that? Well, you'd hope all of us would. I'm afraid sometimes we don't. We continue to see the one that failed. I keep thinking with this, I keep wondering if Barnabas, this is one of those situations where I wish we had the conversation that went on between the two, because I'd like to hear both sides of this argument. I'd especially like to hear what Barnabas had to say. But in my mind, I don't know if this was in Barnabas's mind, but in my mind, when I picture this scenario, my mind keeps going back to a guy named Peter that was told he was going to mess up, messed up anyway, but Jesus continued to encourage him, didn't he? I still have work for you to do. Because he didn't see him as the failure. He saw the potential. He saw the potential. So they go their separate ways, right? 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Paul is writing to him, Timothy was already planning to go see Paul, or Paul's wanting him to come see him, whichever it is. He wants him to come, but look at verse 11. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark. The one that left us, that you fought with me over, go get him. Go get Mark, and notice why. And bring him with you, for he is useful to me. For ministry, for service. Well, Barnabas was right. Barnabas was right. John Mark turned out okay, didn't he? Was useful for the service, useful for the work. Paul needed him so much that he asked for him specifically. Amazing. all because of the great encourager. The one that encouraged him to continue trying even after he had failed. Even after he'd failed. Tell them the truth. So encourage them, but don't candy coat it. Tell them the truth. If they were speaking and they misquoted a verse, let them know they misquoted the verse. That's okay. But do it how? In love. Because guess what? You've misquoted verses too. And it may have been in public. See, they need to be told the truth. But it needs to be in love. I always try to find different ways to serve teens. I don't know what it is about me, but it's just something I feel like I need to do. And right now, the way I'm doing that is I'm a certified abstinence education instructor in the state of Kansas. So I get to go into high schools and junior highs and try to convince them to wait until they're married. That's the goal. Now that sounds kind of daunting. But you know what I found in doing that? Even amongst some of what we would consider some of the most ungodly teenagers, we might say, they love to be told the truth. They love it. Even when they disagree with me. They might sit there and argue with me. We have, at the end of the class, we have a sheet, like a survey thing that they fill out. And one of them, you know, one of the places on there is, what did you like about the presentation? Because it goes over a couple of days. It's like a 3-hour presentation. What did you like about the presentation? I am amazed at how many times I have gotten something like, thank you for telling us the truth. Thank you for treating us like adults that can handle this information. It's amazing. You know what that tells me? They feel like too many times they're being treated like little kids. In some ways they are, because we know stuff they don't know that they don't even need to know yet. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But they want to be told the truth. Remember back in Psalm 78? We will not hide the things from them that they need to know. What good does it do? What good does it do? Why shouldn't our teenagers, as they're going into teen classes, they're going out into teenage society, why shouldn't they know the things they need to know? Why would we keep something from them? Why would we try to pretend like the dinosaurs don't matter? Why would we try to pretend that this whole evolution thing is just going to kind of fade away? Why should we hide the truths about other world religions from them? What are we afraid of? They're going to get curious and look for that information anyway. And it might as well come from us, as long as we're telling them the truth. Tell them the truth. They want to know the truth. Instruction. We know what they don't know they will need to know, so we have to let them know. I can remember when I was a teenager. Maybe you can too. I had it all wrapped up in a nice little neat box and had it all down. I knew it. Got it. No problem. I know. I got it. Looking back, I didn't know much. I thought I did, but I didn't. Maybe you were the same way, or maybe I was just the only arrogant one. I don't know. They don't even know what they need to know. They don't even know what they need to know. That's why, as Mark was saying the other night, that's why they ask questions like, why do I even need to know this How am I going to use it for the rest of my life? See, they don't even understand that. It's up to us to let them know that, to help them understand, to lead them down the right path. And that's instruction. And how are we going to do that? An hour a week on Sunday mornings? I'm afraid that's probably not enough. What was it that God told Moses to instruct the children of Israel about teaching the next generation? How often were they supposed to be involved in teaching? Constantly. I don't care if you're walking down the road. I don't care if you're sitting on your front porch. I don't care if you're eating a meal. I don't care what you're doing. You have possibilities of teaching them about God. It's amazing. And I'm afraid sometimes, I know because I've been guilty of it myself, we let those opportunities pass by. And this is the only thing that I do know about missed opportunities. When that opportunity is gone, it's gone. Can't go get it back. You can't recreate it. When the little child asks a question about something, they might not ever ask that question again. Or they might not ask you. So it's important that we are involved in instructing them. And the church can play a very important role in accomplishing that. But as parents, if we're relying on the church to do all of that instruction, we're in trouble. I mean, for most of us, our children on a weekly basis might have the possibility of being around brethren in an instructional type situation, maybe 2 hours on Sunday morning, an hour Sunday night, an hour Wednesday night, 4 hours a week. I didn't add it up, but how many hours are they with their friends? Or watching TV or movies or on the internet or any of those things? In the U.S. today, right now, the average teenager and the average high school student in the U.S. spends 2 hours a week with their family. Did you know that? 2 hours a week. That's not even four meals, hardly. But they spend 77 hours a week with all kinds of different media. Why are we shocked when the next generation falls away and we give them 4 hours a week of religious instruction? We shouldn't be surprised. We should expect it. That would be normal. A child that grows up to be a mature Christian and all they got when they were a kid was 3 or 4 hours a week instruction, to me, that's amazing. That's a testament to that person, not their parents. We have to be involved in instructing our children. Expectations. What do you expect? As adults, it's easy, isn't it, for us to look around and, wow, I just don't know where the church is going to go now. I don't know where the elders are going to come from. I don't know where the evangelists are going to come from. I don't know where the teachers are going to come from. That's easy. That's apathy. But I meant what I said at the very beginning of this lesson today. I am amazed at our teenagers. We have a great group of teenagers. I think the future looks very bright if we can keep it going. See, that's an expectation. And what happens with expectations in kids is they usually live up to our expectations. So if they hear us walking around going, wow, I just don't know what's going to happen in the next 20 years or 30 years or 50 years, I'm not sure how to respond to a statement like that, really. I'm not sure if it's devaluing the next generation, the abilities and potential of them, or if it's a prideful statement about my generation. I don't know which it is. Because either we're the best Christians that have ever walked on the face of the planet, or there's absolutely no hope for the next group. I don't know which they're thinking when somebody says that. I told the kids downstairs when we started to study, we went through these things too, but I said, this is what I want to do with you this week. I want to encourage you. I want to instruct you. I want to tell you the truth. And when we got here, I said, I have great expectations for you. High. It's just a matter of whether you can live up to them or not. But I think you can. It's so important for us to have a mentally positive outlook on the future generation. Because I'll guarantee you, they hear enough about how miserable and low and pointless their generation is. They hear that all the time, other places. They need to hear encouragement. They need to hear how what we expect of them. And what we expect of them comes from Psalm 78. I expect them to be better than me. That's what I expect. Because I know me. And I'm confident they can do better. I'm confident they can do better. I'm going to run through kind of some of the things we talked about in the teen class this morning, because obviously I didn't give them this lesson, because that doesn't make any sense. So what I did with them was I tried to walk them through some things that I think they need to think about and look into and get a handle on as they're going through their teen years. So I want you to see, because there's parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and church family in here, that I want you to see what we talked about. Because these are things that they're now thinking about. So guess what that means? It's time to teach. You have a teaching opportunity. Now, I won't go into detail about everything we talked about, because I've only got 9 minutes to do what I did in 50. So here we go. We talked about the idea of doubting. How when I was, and I used some people's names that weren't down there, I hope it's okay. When I was a teenager and a young teenager, I said, I can remember seeing Tom Dennis and Tom Woody and Rick Sparks and all these other men and women in the church. And I just thought, wow, they've got it all together. They absolutely are 100% sure of everything. When that's not true, is it? We all go through our doubts. So what happened was, when I would have doubts, oh, that made me feel bad. Boy, I just must be the worst. No, doubts are okay. We talked about how they're normal. It's unavoidable. They can help us grow. You'll have to get some of these notes from them downstairs, because we won't have time to go through it all. If you commit to working through your doubts and answering it on the other side. That's what doubts can do for us. It can help us grow. And I took them to Proverbs 3, 5 through 8. Remember that one? Trust in the Lord. Don't trust in what you know or think you know. Let God lead you. Do the right thing and avoid the bad. Pretty good verse if you're having struggles somewhere. We talked about dealing with mistakes. We talked about Adam and Eve and how the first thing is they were ashamed, and then they were afraid, and then they isolated themselves, they hid, and then they started blaming everybody. Even God, right? The woman that you gave to be with me. It's your fault. Don't worry, moms. I let the guys know that never the woman's fault. Then I asked him, is that what God, what's God's plan for me? Is that what he, how he wants me to react? Does he want me to, oh, I got my pointer up here. Does he want me to feel shame? Does he? Yeah, he put it there. There's a reason. Does he want me to be afraid? Yeah, that's why he tells me about hell. Does he want me to isolate myself? No. Instead of isolating myself, he wants me to confess. Bring myself into other people that can help me. Does he want me to blame everybody else? No, he wants me to accept responsibility and repent. Can you see how if a teenager can get a hold of that now, how that will help them as they grow? Priorities. Yeah, parents, we love talking to our kids about priorities, right? Getting things in their proper place. What comes first? Oops. We talked about... I had to get to my notes because I didn't put all this stuff on the... We talked about Philippians 3, 13 through 15. Putting things that are behind, looking forward to things that are ahead. We talked about Psalm 27, 4. One thing I have desired. Okay? We talked about being a servant. Sometimes a teenager just doesn't really know what to do. How can I help? I'm just a teenager. Well, we as adults can think of all kinds of things they could do, right? To be a servant. So we talked about Matthew 23, where he talks about the difference between the Pharisees and Sadducees that wanted all of the people to see everything about them and wanted to boast about their religious ability. And Jesus said that's not what being a servant is. Being a servant is not always being up in front doing the big things. Sometimes it's just doing little things that nobody ever knows about. And I said, I gave him that goal. I said, you find a whole bunch of little things and do stuff for people and don't even tell anybody. Have fun with that. Influence. We talked about their ability to influence others. That was the thing I was talking about. We went to Proverbs chapter 27. We talked about verse 17, iron sharpens iron. How they can be a direct influence on people. And we talked about Proverbs 27:19, the mirror, the water being a mirror, and how they can be an indirect influence. They might not even know. You know, two of them commented this way. You know, sometimes we'll never even know the kind of influence we might have. See? Things like that from my teenagers encourage me. And it wasn't my kid. Okay? Then they started talking about... Guess what they started talking about next? The little kids that are looking up to them. Did you know they feel a little bit of responsibility about that already? See what I mean about I'm encouraged? We got a good group of young people. And then we talked about how the world should see us. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. We talked about that Gentiles should be able to rejoice to God over when they see us doing what we're supposed to be doing. And we talked about the only way they would know to do that is if we've mentioned God and they know that's why we're doing the right thing. We talked about the flip side of that, peer pressure. Yeah, we're supposed to influence other people, but what about when people influence us? We talked about Proverbs 1, 10 through 16. Not going the way of the sinner. Not going that path. Trying to avoid that. But then we also talked about the flip side of that peer pressure coin, which is, what if I can influence them? Positive peer pressure. We talked about relationships with the opposite gender, although I promised them we wouldn't spend very much time on this because I know they spent a lot of time on that the first week. Excellent. But we talked about 1 Corinthians 13 as a guide to how they should interact with the one that they think is special. You won't get all these. But patient, this is the Doug translation of what 1 Corinthians 13 is talking about. Patience is present. Kindness is consistent. Jealousy, envy, and security give way to truth, confidence, and integrity. Good manners are natural. You don't have to work at it. You make decisions based on what's best for the other person. Gentleness overcomes things like irritability, grudges, resentment, those things that can destroy a relationship. Good actions are celebrated. Bad behavior is avoided. Optimism's easy. You always see things on the positive side, or try to. And determination to succeed never wavers. That's what 1 Corinthians 13 is telling us. We haven't gotten here, but we'll get here tomorrow, so I'll go ahead and let you see. We're going to talk about 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 12. Peter's list of the do's and do nots. Love his brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, be a blessing, seek peace. The don'ts, repaying evil for evil, exchanging verbal abuses, speaking with intent to harm, trying to deceive. And how the results, if you do what you're supposed to, you're going to love life, you're going to see good days, the eyes of the Lord will be upon you, He will hear your prayers, but if you don't, the face of the Lord will be against you. That's all right there in that verse. It's all right there. And then I'm going to encourage them with five habits. Okay? Five habits. Because these are five things that I wish I would have gotten all five of these down a whole lot earlier than I did. And some of them I'm still working on. Read your Bible daily. If we can get our teenagers and our young people to read their Bible every single day, that would be a step. Praying to God every day. And this does not include mealtime. Find a time just to talk to Him. Attend all the services of the church. This isn't just the required ones. This is everyone you can possibly get to. Giving. Not just money, but of time and talents as well. Any way that you can find to give. Keeping a strong association with Christians. Okay. So how can we raise up a godly generation more godly than ourselves? We can encourage them so that even when they fail, they try. We can tell them the truth all the time. Teaching. Teaching, 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 and more teaching. And we can have high expectations. I did not leave any time at all for questions. That was not on purpose. But if you have any, you can put them in the box, you can see me, and we'll address them tomorrow. You have 15 minutes.